Talk.
Talk show.
Talk back.
Talk radio.
Talk your talk.
Walk your talk.
KGNU Talk.
Call in.
Call in and talk.
Call in and connect.
Connections.
Friday mornings at 8:30.
On KGNU.
And good morning, Colorado. Welcome to Connections. I'm Roger Wendell. The time is 8:32. And we have a two-part program for you this morning. First part of Connections will be spent with author Will Everett. He wrote Will Live Tomorrow. And we'll be discussing the dangers of aid workers or what aid workers face in Afghanistan. Second half of the program at the top of the hour will feature Scott Yuha. He's author of Silver Ships, the science fiction series. But our discussion will focus on NASA's collaboration with Israel and other nations in exploring space. I want to remind you, of course, that tomorrow is Halloween. You probably don't need much of a reminder for that. Immediately after Halloween, on Sunday morning, the government dictates that we play with our clocks again. So you'll gain an hour this weekend. Back to our program. As a journalist, Will Everett has reported from the Middle East, South Asia, West Africa for NPR, the BBC, and other outlets. With Walter Cronkite, Will wrote and produced the 2006 documentary, The World War I Living History Project, the only media project to honor the last surviving veterans of World War I. His novel, Will Live Tomorrow, is based on his time as an aid worker in Afghanistan. Will, welcome to KGNU.
Roger, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Good to have you. Before we talk about your novel and some of Afghanistan's history and your own experiences there, I'd like to review some current events in Afghanistan, specifically the Hindu Kush earthquake that devastated parts of Pakistan and Afghanistan on Monday of this week. Do you have any indication of how the people are doing at this point after that huge earthquake?
You know, Roger, I left Afghanistan a month ago. I'm currently in Texas on hiatus. I am getting reports from friends in different provinces of Afghanistan, and that's one of the marvels of social media is my friends are on Facebook checking in, saying I'm okay, and for the most part, everyone seems to be doing all right.
Okay, real good. I don't know if you had a chance to listen to Democracy Now! And Amy Goodman this morning, but she addressed at length the airstrike on, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, the Kunduz Hospital on October 3rd, earlier this month. Can you give us an idea, in your opinion, based on your experiences in Afghanistan, what do you think happened there at that hospital?
Well, you know, Afghanistan is a very complex battle space with a lot of insurgent targets, strayers. You break it, you own it. And until it's fixed, it's ours.
Was that the opinion of the world then at the time of this, the proposal to draw down the troops, Obama's decision there?
Well, I think the international community pretty much said, we're done, when they started withdrawing in 2012 and 13. And, these complex military decisions are sort of outside of my parvenu.
Okay.
But I have a very sort of keyhole glimpse of what happened in Afghanistan beginning in 2005 when I started going there.
Fair enough. Well, I appreciate you attempting to answer these questions. It was just what's been on the radar screen, obviously, as of late. Let's get into who are the Afghanis. There are at least a dozen major ethnic groups. I'd have difficulty pronouncing a lot of the names, Tajik, Uzbek, and 10 others. But tell us, who are the Afghanis? Who are these people?
Well, Afghanistan has its roots in the old Persian Empire. It is a collection of peoples of a wide mix of ethnicities, from Uzbekistan, from Iran, even from Mongolia through the Hazara people. And of course, the major ethnicity, the Pashtuns. That mix of ethnicities reflects Afghanistan's geography as the crossroads of the Silk Road and the convergence point for many people, and it continues to be a convergence point, and that's probably why it's been at the center of international events for the past decade.
We've certainly touched on war here a moment ago, and I wanted to ask, you know, basically the story of Afghanistan as this crossroads, and beyond that seems so tragic to me. It's one of the most impoverished, war-torn nations on the planet. Again, you know, it's not a history quiz here, but give us a little bit of history about the British conflict in Afghanistan, certainly the Russian involvement, but basically it looks like almost 200 years of war, continuous war in Afghanistan.
Right, right. 200 plus years of war leading up to the past three decades of intense conflict. Of course, beginning with the Russian invasion, followed by a bloody civil war and a bloodier Taliban rule, and then the American invasion. So I'd say that even given 200 years of conflict, I'd say everything ramped up just in the past 30 years. And during that time, a lot of old traditional knowledge was lost, especially among farmers. And you have to remember, Afghanistan is 80% of Afghans derive their income from some form of agriculture. And that's why some of the most important aid work is done through agriculture.
The time is 8:41. You're listening to Connections. My guest is Will Everett, author of We'll Live Tomorrow, and we'll be discussing the dangers of aid workers, the dangers aid workers face, of course, in Afghanistan. If you want to join the conversation, we do have open lines at 303-442-4242. Again, that's 303-442-4242. Will, the foreword of your book suggests that for humanitarian aid to succeed, it must have the support of the people it seeks to help, plus a stable environment. We've talked about the environment a little bit here, but tell us a little bit more about the people. Are the people supportive of the efforts of you and your colleagues conducting aid work in Afghanistan?
They're certainly interested in projects that will provide them with a better livelihood. Unfortunately, many times American largesse, American munificence and generosity doesn't always take into consideration what the Afghan people can maintain. We don't always build sustainability into our projects. And so you have these legendary $15 million hospitals that are sitting dormant because there's not adequate electricity or adequate staff or adequate roads leading to the hospital. The reconstruction of Afghanistan is the largest reconstruction effort the United States has ever attempted. It's larger than the Marshall Plan that rebuilt Europe after World War II, when adjusted for inflation, $110 billion. And we have certainly poured American money, treasure, into Afghanistan to make it a better place. But a lot of times we've created projects that simply cannot continue once we're gone. You know, the Afghan government needs $6 to $10 billion a year to function. Afghanistan raises $2 billion a year in revenue, which means we've basically created a client state. We've created a government that can't pay its own bills.
How long is this going to continue? Is there any optimism for the future? Is it possible that they could become self-sustaining, or are you convinced that we have to continue supporting them in this regard?
I don't know how we can avoid supporting them unless we want to see them turn into a failed state.
Can you give us an idea, too, of some of the projects? You mentioned the hospital without electricity. Not so much to focus on the negative, but just to give us a general idea of what aid workers are involved in Afghanistan and what typically are the projects. My guess would be things like roads, of course, infrastructure, electricity, sewage, those kinds of things. Your take?
Well, a lot of our aid projects in Afghanistan, especially during the war years when things were really kinetic, focused on rebuilding agriculture. We came in and we rebuilt the irrigation system so farmers could have water. We gave out innumerable metric tons of seed and fertilizer so farmers could get back on their feet. And we created a lot of cash for work programs which were means of diverting fighting age young men away from the insurgency. That's how a lot of the aid money was spent during the war years. And during that period, that's when I came into Afghanistan in 2010. These projects were aimed at short-term objectives, stabilizing the country so that things could get back, people could get back on the feet, the government could get running, and the military could do its job and push back the insurgency. So that's when I came on board. I was in Afghanistan starting in 2005 as a journalist, but it was in 2010 that I began doing aid work there.
Who ultimately coordinates the U.S. aid? You know, I read a little bit, of course, about the United States Agency for International Development. Are they ultimately the boss, as it were, in this, or is it just a hodgepodge of military input, non-government organizations, directives from Obama? Give us a sense of how this is coordinated and who decides.
Well, the bulk of aid that's done through the U.S. government does take place through USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development. It is an arm of the State Department. It's not primarily a humanitarian organization, but one that works to promote American interests abroad. And of course, American interests are promoted when societies are functioning and when there's peace and prosperity. So those projects tend to be focused on improving livelihoods and, you know, maintaining social cohesion. There are, of course, other organizations, smaller ones, that are there working on their own aims to, help disabled people or children or women. But the bulk of the reconstruction spending took place through the military, through their discretionary humanitarian programs, as well as USAID.
How does foreign aid from other countries compare to what we've done in Afghanistan and what we continue to do? Is there no comparison? And also, who else is involved in trying to provide aid?
Well, when you visit Afghanistan, you're constantly seeing reminders of the work that our international partners have done. If you pass through Kabul International Airport, you'll see plaques, signifying that this was built by the Japanese people. Throughout the country, you'll see these reminders of what our partners have done. Of course, the American spending has been quite a bit greater because we had military objectives to see to while we were there. And so, our spending, I would say, probably outmatches our international partners by about 9 to 1.
Interesting. I certainly want to get to your book, We'll Live Tomorrow, and want to talk about that in a little bit of detail before our time together concludes. But kind of drilling down, as it were, what's the daily life like for an aid worker in Afghanistan? What kind of work is it typically, and is it rewarding, challenging, fulfilling? Obviously, it's dangerous, according to your book, and oftentimes terror-filled, but the life of an aid worker in Afghanistan?
Well, most aid workers who are there working on USAID projects live in fortified compounds. I've heard them referred to as the golden cage. You're imprisoned, but you're making lots of money. There are other aid workers who try to live a more normal life, integrated into Afghan society. I know a number of Americans who live in their own homes, who drive cars. They try to live a normal life, as normal as possible in Afghanistan. But I would say, for the most part, aid workers, they live in fairly confined circumstances. And a lot of the work we do over there, we have to do by remote control because we simply can't leave those compounds to go monitor our projects. And, that's often to the detriment of the quality of the project.
About 9 years ago, I interviewed Greg Mortensen on his book, Three Cups of Tea, and, there was a lot of controversy surrounding that afterwards. And not to ask for an indictment against Greg, of course, but I'm wondering, does that kind of thing adversely affect what you're trying to do in Afghanistan? In other words, do locals look at us differently because what may have been done in the past was misrepresented?
No, I think locals everywhere pretty much have a short-term focus. They look at their own immediate needs and their own self-interest. So I don't think there's been really any blowback from things like, you know, like with Greg Mortensen's efforts. I don't think that had any impact whatsoever.
Okay. You mentioned, of course, the protective, I think you called it the golden compound, or the protection that aid workers are afforded, you know, with their living quarters and that kind of thing. How closely do aid workers interface or connect with our military or coalition forces? Is there regular contact, communications? Tell us a bit about that.
Not so much anymore. When I started in 2010, there was a considerable amount of interaction with the military because USAID programs were working in lockstep with the military. A lot of the aid work we were doing was done with military objectives in mind. For instance, if the insurgency was running hot in Zari district down in Kandahar, the military would say, you know what, we need more cash for work down in Zari. So the USAID program that I was working on would shift its budget so that we were doing more work in that area to try to draw some of the fighting age young men away from the insurgency.
Okay, time is 8:51. You're listening to Connections. Again, my guest is Will Everett. He's author of We'll Live Tomorrow. And we're kind of talking about the dangers that aid workers face in Afghanistan. Will, I wanted to back up just a little bit, talking again about the life of an aid worker in Afghanistan. And, you know, I noted that Islam was brought to Afghanistan during the 8th and 9th century by the Arabs. And I'm just wondering, how big is the Muslim community throughout the country? And can you help us understand what the role of Islam is in daily life for not only the locals, but maybe its effect on you as an aid worker?
Well, Afghanistan is an Islamic republic. I would say that the level of Islamic adherence is probably very close to 100%. There's not a lot of religious freedom in Afghanistan. And yeah, Islam has a lot to do with our daily lives in Afghanistan.
You as aid workers.
Exactly, as aid workers. We have to interface with Afghan staff, and we have to respect their values. But at the same time, you know, we're approaching our work and our daily lives as foreigners with a different set of values. So sometimes we have to often sublimate those values in order to function in that society. For instance, if you're homosexual, you're probably not going to want to say much about that because that runs right in the face of Islamic values in Afghanistan.
And I find that ironic, too, that specific topic, because one of the main characters in your book, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, Karamula, a young
right.
Afghani man who was kind of forced into prostitution as a bachi bazi. Maybe you can explain that for us.
Yeah, bachi bazi is the abduction of young men, usually between the ages of 10 and 14, by powerful figures, warlords, military commanders, police chiefs. This is something that has existed in Afghanistan since its pre-Islamic years. Alexander the Great, when he passed through Afghanistan, he picked up a bacha bazi. So it's not something new, but it's something that's growing in popularity. The Taliban got rid of it, but in the years after 2001, we've seen it flourishing in Afghanistan. An organization called Hagar International estimates that 1 in 10 Afghan boys has had some direct experience with sexual trafficking. And this is something I wanted to bring to light in my novel.
And what surprises me, though, is it's in complete disregard for Islamic law or rule.
Right. It's something that is condemned by Islam. And again, the Taliban condemned it and treated it with, you know, if you are abducting or sexually abusing a child, you will be executed. However, a lot of the mullahs are practitioners of bachabazi these days. And, you know, in many cases, because it's practiced by extremely powerful, dangerous figures, people have little choice but to just turn the other way, because rule of law doesn't afford the punishments that the practice deserves.
And, of course, not just in Afghanistan. It's worldwide. We don't have a lot of time left together, unfortunately, but let's go to the phones. I think we can squeeze in one call. Jim has been waiting. Jim, good morning. You're on Connections.
Hi. I just wonder if I'm totally brainwashed by the left, but to me, everything I read about Afghanistan and Pakistan is it's just a cover for the U.S. to try and compete with Russia or something. Like, we want to have our own pipelines in there to transport natural gas and to get, we want to get mineral resources out of there. I mean, it seems like we're always paying off the president of Afghanistan or his relatives or various warlords just to pretend to be on our side, and we're doing the old technique of divide and conquer where we keep trying to stir up fighting between different sides so we can not have anyone else in charge. I mean, we should be spending our money here in the U.S., having jobs here and fixing things here and providing college education. Why the heck do we spend all this money except to, you know, help Lockheed Martin or the U.S. military have more money? I mean, the whole thing, there's stuff in the news about how the CIA uses aid agencies to try and spy on other countries. This is just a sham. Whenever people talk about human rights in Afghanistan or women's rights, it's just trying to have some dressing so we can go in there and have a bunch of failed war going on, spend lots of money, and make people scared. So I may be totally convinced of some weird position, but from my mind, you're talking to this guy is just all baloney.
All right, Jim, thanks for that. Will, your response, please.
Well, I think he's right. We have spent a lot of money in Afghanistan. Once again, it's the largest reconstruction effort the United States has ever attempted. I'm not privy to some of these high-level strategic issues that he refers to. Like I said, I have a keyhole view of what has happened in Afghanistan since I started going there in 2005. But I would say, you know, a lot of people are saying exactly what the caller is saying. Why do we keep spending so much money over there? The Special Investigator General for Afghanistan Reconstruction continues to bring to light these revelations of misspent, misappropriated funding, billions spent on projects that have achieved no results whatsoever. And I think this is something that should be part of the American dialogue.
Jim also brought up the idea, and I think it's pretty widespread, that the CIA and other government operations are trying to get a foothold or one up on the Russians in Afghanistan, and almost at times using, you know, aid work as kind of a wedge to get in and maybe even collect data and intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think that there's any real data collection going on among these aid projects, and certainly not the ones I've worked on. But yeah, it is important to remember that USAID is an arm of the State Department, and it is there to pursue American interests abroad. It's not a humanitarian mission. It's not there to make the world a better place. You know, there are high-level strategic issues at stake.
Unfortunately, Will, we're just about out of time, so I want to end with asking, what do you think the solutions are for Afghanistan at this time? Continuing aid work, military intervention, just your take on it.
My take is, you know, we can't pull out at this point. We opted to invade that country. We tore things up, tried to make it a better place, and we've got to stay the course. But we need to apply more conditionality to our aid. We need to put more strings on this money that we're pouring into Afghanistan.
Okay. Will, I want to thank you for your time on Connections this morning.
Great. Thrilled to be there. Thank you.
Glad to have you. My guest has been Will Everett. He's author of We'll Live Tomorrow. It's about Afghanistan. It's available in bookstores everywhere. Up next will be Scott Yuha. We're going to be talking about NASA and collaboration in the space program. That'll be up next. The time is 9 o'clock straight up. You're listening to Connections. I'm Roger Wendell, and this is KGNU Boulder, KGNU Denver, 88.5 FM, 1390 AM, with translator K229 AC in Nederland, Colorado, at 93.7 megahertz. We'll be back in a moment.
Set your mind free. Counter, counter, counter culture. Tell you what's the next thing.
And thank you, Zen Cowboys. We're back. Time is 9:01. This is Connections. I'm Roger Wendell. Joining me by phone is Scott Yuha. Scott has had an extensive career as a senior manager in the technical education and software development industries with degrees in biology and broadcast communications. He has been driven by an innate interest in computers since his initial adoption of an IBM PC in 1981. Scott's newest novels, The Silver Ships, Libre, and Meridian, which is coming out tomorrow, by the way, are part of a planned 5-book series with other potential spin-offs in the works. Scott, good morning. Welcome to KGNU. Whoops, let's try that again.
Thank Scott, you for having me on the show.
Scott, let's try that again. I missed you there. Welcome.
Okay. I said welcome, and thank you for having me on the show, Roger.
Good to have you here. Before talking about NASA and the future of space exploration, can you tell us a bit about your Silver Ships series?
Yes. It's started out as a planned trilogy, but it's been extended since then because the fans have told me if I quit, I'm in danger of losing my life. So that part I'm willing to listen to. The Silver Ships is a story of two colony ships from Earth, one with a good start and one with a bad. And they developed over a period of about 700 years. And it's the story of a young man who, pretty much a loner, managed to find a derelict spaceship from one of the cultures, and what he thinks is derelict, but he actually revives an AI by the name of Julian and 18 Meridians. He's taken from a world of just developing technology in the solar system and plunged into one with artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, genetic sculpting with people, and yet he accepts that new world, reaches out a hand, because what's damaged that ship is attacking their entire civilization, and he's the kind of individual who reaches out and lends a hand no matter what. And that's a theme throughout much of my books, is the side of humanity where we help one another rather than to reach into destructive phases.
And if I understand it correctly, Meridian is a continuation of the series, and it's available starting tomorrow, I believe.
Actually, yes. I'm real pleased. Got book three out. I was told after book one, it's the toughest thing in the world to write two, and I'm having such a great time that I don't see myself stopping. And bless the hearts of the fans, there are enough of them to keep me working full-time as a writer.
Yep. Congratulations. Okay.
Thank you.
NASA has had some astonishing achievements with the Opportunity Mars rover here over the past couple of years, and now the New Horizons Pluto flyby. You know, I was captivated by the photos of Charon and some of the neighboring moons. But there seems to be a sense of the budget limitations are going to hamper the future of manned space missions. What are NASA's plans for the future, and do you think the budget is kind of slowing things down at the moment?
Oh, the budget is definitely an issue. One of the former NASA astronauts, Walt Cunningham, he was testifying on the federal budget, and he said that the present NASA budget is well below what we were doing with the Apollo missions. And he said at the height of the Apollo program that the NASA had about 4.5% of the federal budget, and now it's at 0.5, one-ninth. I think there's a whole issue here that NASA, you know, is looking to bring up that budget, and that we are looking from a global economic point of view to say, wait a minute, why aren't we spending the money at home? Which I think is short-sighted. I see space exploration as a tremendous capital investment program that will eventually return, but it's a long-term process. And we are not the only ones who are questioning, well, I should say we are questioning going, whereas other countries are very much in that program. I mean, so there have been some recent announcements that are kind of mind-boggling. Russia is revitalizing their Luna project, and they're picking right up with Luna 25, 26, 27, etc. And interesting that Luna 27, which is going to go back, this is a set of robotic missions to the dark side of the moon, particularly the ice cap, where they can hope to, you know, with ice water, you can get fuel in terms of hydrogen and oxygen breaking that, and you can also have a water source. And European Space Agency is joining in with Russia on the Luna 27 mission, because with their capabilities that they've produced for the asteroid work, which is a combination of drilling and testing on board, that's something that Russia was looking to have, and the European Space Agency, ESA, already has that well developed. So it's interesting that that is a pairing coming in the near future.
And I want to explore that or talk about that in more depth here in a moment, but kind of backing up to the percentage of the budget, you mentioned it was less, well under 1%. But the figure that I found here in preparation for the program was that we're spending, I believe, around $40 billion, with a B, $40 billion on the space program. To me, that doesn't sound like very much. I would guess we spend that much on one nuclear submarine or who knows what. $40 billion, but yet... what I also found is that's more money than all the other countries combined what's spent on their space programs. Does that sound about right?
Yes.
Despite the ambitions of the Russians, Luna and China, and Luna 27 and the Chinese programs, we're still outspending everybody combined.
At the present time. And when you're looking at that in historic figures versus what I see being set up by the China National Space Agency with their, and I hope I don't destroy the pronunciation, the Chang'e missions. They, in 2014, sent their first fly mission around the moon. They have a series planned out of their Wenchang, which is a brand new space shot location. They have a series of robotic missions planned to go back to the moon and to also do testing and sampling on the moon. And what we're seeing is NASA has led the space exploration in many ways for decades, but you see these other agencies popping up and future expenditures set for the late 2020s and beyond. I mean, what is incredible, if you search just on space administrations, you come up with Russia, Japan, China, European, Canadian, Indian, French, UK, Italian, Iranian, German.
Yeah.
The list goes on and on. And you're right, $40 billion does sound a lot, and that's weird from what we are spending to others, but it's nothing compared to what could be spent, and especially if you start putting them together, which is, I think, what one of the reasons we signed, NASA did, with Israel. We originally had an agreement, a pact with them. Unfortunately, Israel's first astronaut,
Elon,
to go into space,
Elon Ramon, I believe.
Right, he died in the Columbia accident. So, you know, that it was a great beginning and a tragic endpoint there. But we've entered into another agreement. I think it spreads the advent of the technology. I think it spreads the science around the manpower and the funding. I think more should be done in that way. This shouldn't be a race like it was between Russia and the U.S., back in the 60s and 70s. It shouldn't be that type of focus. It should be more of a global approach, although this whole question of sharing technology with certain countries who shall remain nameless is important to consider. In the beginning, I guess it should be more of our allies and combining our budgets, combining our technology, and treating it a little bit more like we have the International Space Station.
9/11 is the time. You're listening to Connections. My guest this morning is Scott Juha, and it's spelled J-U-C-H-A. He's author of The Silver Ships, a series of books, 442-4242. Again, that's 303-442-4242. Scott, I wanted to back up just a little bit. You mentioned China just a moment ago, and in my test call to you earlier before the program, you mentioned China space program and kind of tied it in a little bit with their island building in the South China Sea. And I'll have to say I left that brief conversation kind of questioning that. Can you maybe revisit it for a moment? Is there some kind of connection between the Chinese ambitions in the South China Sea and their space exploration plans?
No, not that I read about. What I just thought was incredible is that there is this push from various countries now for exploration, specifically to start with the moon, robotic sampling, etc. And yet these countries that are looking towards that area of space where, according to international treaties, you can't, or in which China is an agreed signatory, you can't claim anything in space for yourself, yet are turning around and participating in these expansionist and disruptive programs of theirs here on Earth. And it's such a dichotomy between those, that positioning, you know, to want to go into space, to have an international treaty which forbids a national identity on, say, the moon or any other body out there, and yet here pushing and fighting for extra space, such as China building the islands in the South Asian Sea there. Those two ramming together, if you will, as national directions just always flabbergast me.
Yeah, and not to get too far off my page of notes here, but, you know, they may be looking at it in the reverse, wondering what we're doing, for example, in the Northern Mariana Islands when we're signatory to the same space agreements that they are. But that's a whole nother talk show, I'm sure.
It is.
But the Chinese Space Agency, it's a China National Space Administration, and you're suggesting that with these ambitious plans, I think they're talking about human presence on the moon in 2020, so we can anticipate them really increasing their spending for their space program compared to what they're doing now.
Yes, certainly. When you realize that it was only in November 1st, I think, 2014, that their little fly spacecraft looped around the moon and returned to parachute down in China's Inner Mongolia after just 8 days of flight. And that was in 14. And their Shenzhou 5, which is the robotic lunar sampler, is slated launch in 2017. So within 3 years, you have five launches, of which one will be landing on the moon. That's a tremendous ramp up in spending.
Kind of in contrast to me, anyway, is Iran claimed that it had sent a chimp into orbit, suborbit, 75 miles above the planet, and they're suggesting they're going to have a very ambitious space program, possibly sending somebody into space by 2020. I'm a little bit skeptical, and I know we're not going to focus on Iran, but do you have any thoughts about the Iranian space program at this point?
No, not really. There's been statements, but then not a lot has been able to be proven, as far as I can read. But I think what's been grabbing the headlines more than anything else has been the European Space Agency, how well they did with their landing on the asteroid for as little budget money as they contributed into it. We're not talking billions, we're talking hundreds of millions.
Yeah, and although there was a little bit of a bounce on that particular mission, I guess, it's quite the achievement, and they can be congratulated, especially in light of the small amount of money they've spent relatively. But that takes me back to what you had mentioned earlier, their collaboration with the Luna 27 mission and Russia and the European Space Agency. It's encouraging to see this kind of collaboration, but it kind of astonishes me or surprises me at times, especially with the tensions in Georgia and the Ukraine. What's your take on that as far as the European view of what would be considered Russian aggression and then maybe turning around and collaborating in space?
It was definitely a bit of a shocker to read. You realize, of course, that from the technological point of view, it's very smart of the Russians because Philae came with ESA, which is the European Space Agency, came with ESA's capability, the sampling of what was done, and the package on board, which is critical because part of the cost for us for moon sampling was the return of the physical samples, whereas with Philae, you had an onboard lab which is doing the sampling right there because Philae isn't coming back. Which keeps the cost down. Very smart, and it's part of the capability of our new technologies that have been produced over the last 20 years. So Russia reaches out to the European Space Agency to borrow that technology to put onto the Luna 27. They're picking up at Luna 25 as their first shot, and Luna 27 will be the landing, the sampling on the moon. So Russia reaches out to European Space Agency. Well, European Space Agency doesn't want to be left behind. So what do they get out of it? They get the information, the sampling. They get the Russian rocket and booster up there. They hitch on, if you will, to what the Russian program and the Russian power provides in their rocket and landing sophistication. So it's a matter that we see, just like Israel is saying, wait a minute, we don't want to get left behind either. Let's join back up with the U.S. European Space Agency doesn't want to get left behind either. It's smart moves on the part of these agencies to team up with whoever's going. And yet, like you said, in contrast, here is this where the European Union is part of this process of limiting a lot of Russian asset simply because of what they're doing in Ukraine. So I sometimes wonder what kind of conversations go on with the diplomats versus the scientists in these various conversations, because it is confusing.
Well, what you've outlined here and explained certainly makes it clear what the benefits are for a lot of these nations. But again, drilling back to the recent agreement just a couple of weeks ago to collaborate with Israel, of obvious benefit to them. But what's the benefit in the case of the United States, NASA, in collaborating with Israel? Obviously, there's benefit for Israel, but NASA is so advanced and has so many resources. What's the benefit for us in signing this agreement here this month?
I think people may not realize the extent of technological development in Israel. It's not often heralded or a big banner waved about it, but there has been incredible technological advancements. I just read an article the other day, and it's slightly off topic, but it goes to prove something. I'm sitting out here in San Diego, and we're in our fifth year of water shortage here. Israel's already looked at that problem decades ago and started building water treatment plants, desalination plants, actually, and recently are bringing online a tremendous plant whose technology is so smart, so far advanced of almost anything else in the world, that they're already leaping towards 40% of all water consumption in Israel now is through desalination. And it's the technology that they've added into this process that allows it done at huge volume. This is a country that is putting their scientists, their brains, their young people to work, and highly stresses science and math programs. They are small, but they are a great partner to work with going forward. NASA may have a lot amount of money, but scientific invention is not limited just to the power of the dollar. It comes from the brilliance of minds that are steeped in it. And we as a country are slowly losing that edge of some of the brightest young people being focused in the sciences. We're trying to get back to it, but we've definitely fallen from being number one where we were, you know, 30 years ago.
Okay, 9:22 is the time. My guest is Scott Juha. He is author of the Silver Ship Science Fiction series, and we're talking about NASA collaboration, space exploration, and all things related. What I wanted to do also, too, Scott, is we've been talking about collaboration in depth and the benefits, especially with this recent agreement between Israel and the United States. We talked about China earlier, and in preparation for the program, I discovered to my surprise that all researchers from NASA are prohibited from working with Chinese citizens affiliated with the Chinese state enterprise or any Chinese state or enterprise. Congress has banned NASA from using its funds to host Chinese visitors at NASA facilities. So it looks like we're not doing a lot of collaborating with the Chinese. Your take?
And that's probably a smart thing. I was surprised at the announcement after Xi's visit with Obama that they so quickly said, oh, we will stop or we will curtail any of the internet attacks. And within days afterwards, we suffered a number of attacks. It's the duplicity of much of the face of the Chinese from their actions just is something to be careful about. So, yes, I'm in favor of keeping the Chinese at arm's length in terms of our technological development, especially with NASA or the Internet or all things related there. So, yes, I'm very much in favor of that process, like I said, of arm's length, until things change in the way that China approaches both democracy, which is going to be a long stretch for them, people's rights, and proves what they say. Often there's a lot of lip service to it. And so I would keep the technology close to the chest, if you will, from NASA's point of view.
Fair enough. And pushing China aside for the moment, I know that you've been quoted as suggesting that collaboration will open the doors for more innovation and exploration, and you've alluded to that already in our time together. But again, pushing China to the side, how does this collaboration and space exploration, as you've suggested in the past, create new opportunities for our children and our future? And I kind of base this on my own age. I mean, I've been watching the space program with fascination for many decades. I'm afraid to admit that on the air, but you know, I appreciate NASA, and I've been watching it, and it, you know, been enthralled by space exploration. Obvious, you know, having this discussion this morning. But I don't know if it's provided that much opportunity for my fellow humans around the planet. And you're suggesting otherwise.
Definitely. I think that lots of these elements of that NASA has created feedback into our own technology here within our industries. And if you hit NASA sites, you get lists of things that they've done in health and medicine and transportation and environmental agriculture resources. You get a list of some of those specific elements that have come back and been created between engineers within NASA and individuals outside of it. And the other day I was just thinking of, you know, taking that in the future, where it goes. When you look at something like NASA's drones, they're destined for Mars in 2020, and they're supposed to scout the terrain for the rover so that your rover isn't, you know, falling off a cliff or getting into a chasm it's got to back itself out from. And these are supposed to be small helicopter scouts that are going to operate in the Martian atmosphere. And when you realize that the Martian atmosphere is only 1% of the density of Earth's atmosphere, you realize that NASA will have to create a very ultra-efficient means of lift for these little scouts, whether they, you know, enlarge the blades, spin them faster, counter-rotating propellers or something. Whatever intelligent design they come up with, ask yourself the question, if you're producing blades that spin in that thin an atmosphere, where might we employ them here back on Earth? And I was thinking wind turbines. That would mean that you could spin and produce electricity in a lot lower level of wind speed than ever before, and which would allow turbines to be built in locations that right now would not even be thought of. So it's that kind of future possibilities for these innovations. And they're going to have to be a tremendous number of them when you move from just space exploration, where we've been looking at it as a tourist, go and come back, which as it changes to one of, as Buzz Aldrin, Dr. Aldrin calls it, permanence, you realize you're going to have to conquer a great many explorations. And that's why at the top of the program I said it's a capital investment. Put in the money now, and over time you will reap the benefits of it. And there's a reason, for instance, all the mining sampling that is going on. When you start realizing the huge range of minerals that are out there, including which are elements such as titanium and helium-3 that are out there, these represent tremendous resource opportunities. Yes, it will take some money and expenditures to get there, but I believe it'll be worthwhile.
You've certainly done a great job of letting us know what the pros are of this technology and space exploration, but you've also noted in the past that there might be a downside to this technological progress in that it's the damaging power of isolation. You've mentioned that in the past. Can you explain that?
To me, technology is always a dual-edged sword. I think the science behind it, provided it's not been tested in living organisms to any great extent here, that it has a certain neutrality. It's the application. And there are things that help us as individuals, as populations, and that improve our lives. But sometimes when the technology allows us to immerse ourselves in it, to the deficit of paying attention to one another, I think that's where we take technology in the wrong direction. As a human species, our power, I think, our capability comes from taking care of one another. And if you're the kind that is getting on an elevator with one other person, just you and them, and all you're doing is looking at your smartphone and doing your mail, instead of taking 10, 15 seconds while you ride that elevator and saying hello to that person, I think you do a disservice to your species. We've got to keep lifting one another up and not isolating ourselves from it. And sometimes technology can help us isolate. And that's my concern.
Unfortunately, we're out of time, so take this opportunity to find out, is there a better way for people to learn about your writing, your books, and these topics in general?
Yes, my website is Scott Juha, ScottJucha.com, and I provide access to a summary of my books, where to get them, and a blog which lists some of these subjects that we've been talking about. And I just want to say, Roger, thank you very much for having me on the show.
Well, Scott, thank you for appearing on KGNU. Thanks so much.
Okay. Bye.
My guest has been Scott Juha. He's author of the Silver Ships science fiction series. You've been listening to Connections. I'm Roger Wendell. Up next is Terry with the Morning Sound Alternative. Oh, and I don't want to forget to thank Nancy for her help with the phones and all the technical work behind the scenes this morning. Thanks again for supporting your community radio station, KGNU. Have a great weekend.